Thank you very much to the organizers for all the effort and also for the invitation to speak here. So I'll talk about that title, and it has a two because last week I gave a talk as strings, but this talk will be a little bit different. So I hope that either if you were last week or you were not last week, that you can get something out of this talk. And it will be mostly based on working in collaboration with Horacio, who is here, and Ignacio Salazar, both from Argentina. Okay, so I'll start with a very brief motivation. So we have the laws of thermodynamics, and we would like to find similar laws, but now for quantum matter at zero temperature. And quantum information has been great at that, especially, at least from my point of view, in the area of quantum field theory. Okay, so in QFT, we have fixed points that are described by CFTs and RG flows that connect them. Here I have some cartoon. These are flows in the space of, say, couplings in the Hamiltonian. And since more or less the beginning of effective field theory, there was this intuition that this picture is irreversible, so you can go one way but not the other, basically because contributions from microscopic degrees of freedom decouple from long distance. Now, this is very hard to make precise, and the first important result that succeeded in making this precise goes back to 1986. Samolochikov basically proved that in two-dimensional RG flows, the central charge in the UV is always bigger than the central charge in the infrared. Okay? So a bit modeled by this theorem, now the modern goal in this area, I would say, is to find these basically universal RG charges that are intrinsic to the fixed point and that we can show that they decrease under the RG. And there have been various different results using many different methods. So the best known theorems are, okay, the C theorem I just mentioned, the F theorem about irreversibility in 2+1 dimensions, and finally the A theorem about irreversibility for QFT in 3+1 dimensions, and then a bunch of irreversibility results for QFTs with defects or impurities that are also very interesting in different areas. Okay? Now, in this talk, what I'll do is I'll explain the main result of this recent work with Horacio and Ignacio, which is the second derivative inequality for the relative entropy, and I'll present a general proof of this inequality, and I'll explain why this inequality turns out to reproduce all known irreversibility theorems, and so it unifies all of them in a single framework, okay? And the talk will be divided in two parts. In the first part, actually, we'll think about QFT without defects, and we'll present a new proof of these older results. This new proof will turn out to be simpler, and it will lead us to develop some new technology that then we'll use in the second part of the talk to prove this irreversibility formula that also includes defects, okay? So this is the structure. So let's begin. Again, this will be a very brief review in case you do not work in this area. So we'll imagine a unitary relativistic quantum field theory in d-dimensional space-time. And this theory undergoes one of these RG flows that I showed before in the cartoon. So in the UV, there is a conformal fixed point. There is some non-trivial RG flow evolution triggered by relevant operators that we turn on. And we assume that the flow ends on a different infrared conformal fixed point. Okay? And we want to understand this flow in part using the vacuum entanglement entropy, in particular on a sphere of radius R, although I'll talk about other shapes in the talk. But this entanglement entropy is in general very hard to compute. It's divergent, so we have to imagine, for example, a lattice regularization or some other regulator. Okay? But it's much better understood near a fixed point. So in this setup, we would have a fixed point when the radius is very small because that probes the UV, and we would have a different fixed point where the radius is very large where we are probing the infrared CFT. So near each of those fixed points, the entropy has an expansion like this one. So first there are these local terms that are powers of the radius. The first is the area term, and then there are similar terms. All these terms are UV divergent. Basically, these coefficients mu have powers of the lattice cutoff in them to make the entropy dimensionless. But our real interest is in this universal term, the last term in the expansion here, which in even space-time dimensions is a log of R with a coefficient called A, or in odd space-time dimensions is this constant F. Okay? And in particular, we can get rid of most of these UV divergences if we think about differences in entropy, meaning the entropy associated to this QFT that undergoes the RG flow, and the entropy associated to the fixed point, okay? So the fixed point doesn't run, but both of these theories have basically similar UV divergences, so we cancel many of them. This paper from 2017 showed that strong subadditivity plus something called the Markov property of the conformal vacuum that we'll discuss implies this inequality for second derivatives. Okay? And essentially what this inequality does is that it kills this first term here. Okay? So this first term is like a zero mode for this. And then it implies that the next term has a definite sign between the UV and the IR. Now that is enough to prove irreversibility in D equals 2, 3, and 4 dimensions, okay, by some manipulations of this inequality. And beyond 4 dimensions, it allows us to access this term, but not the subleading term that would be the universal term, right? In D equals 4, this term is not there, and you go directly to the log, and this is why this will imply the A theorem. But for example, if you're in D equals 6, there will be some R to the 4, R squared, and then the A log R, and then this would imply, say, the decrease of the R to the 4th term. So it's interesting information about DRG, but it's something that depends on the path that we follow in this field theory space, and it does not imply the decrease of A or F. So far, we don't know what happens beyond 4 dimensions, okay? Now, this proof turns out to be somewhat complicated. It was based on a previous proof by Cassini and Huerta on the F theorem. It requires a somewhat complicated geometry of boosted spheres and density of spheres. So here, I want to present a simpler proof that will essentially exhibit the interplay between strong superadditivity and Lorentz invariance in a more transparent way. So it's equivalent to the older proof, but it will allow us to understand some more things. And this proof is based on thinking about infinitesimal deformations of the following type. So this is the future light cone emanating from a point, and here in red, you find this sphere of radius R that I talked before, so we want to compute the entanglement entropy for that sphere. And now we want to imagine that we consider other regions, for example, this region in blue, that have the property that their boundary still lies on the same light cone as the light cone where this sphere is. Okay, so they differ by null deformations from this sphere. But the region can be more general, and here it's parameterized by some curve that I call gamma. So there is gamma of x hat. X hat are the angles in the light cone, okay? And so this is basically the equation for the boundary of this region for which we want to compute the entanglement entropy, okay? And in particular, if we think that now we perform a small deformation of this boundary, then there will be some Taylor expansion for the entanglement entropy, as you see here, so some functional expansion with the first functional derivative, second functional derivative, and so on. And some notation that we'll use is that this first functional derivative, we'll call it S1, when this expansion is done around the sphere. So when gamma is the sphere, the first functional derivative we'll call S1, and the second functional derivative we'll call S12, okay? In particular, by rotational invariance, it turns out that this S1 does not depend at all on the angle x hat, because if there is only one angle, I cannot form any rotational invariant quantity, so it's just a constant, okay? But then the second order kernel is there non-trivial, and now we want to focus on a particular case of this infinitesimal deformation, which is that we take this sphere and we boost it a little bit. So that's a special case of a null deformation of the type I've drawn here. In the picture here, you see a transverse cut of this deformation. So I'm just cutting this by a plane to make it easier to see what I'm doing. So I'm choosing some direction n on which I'm boosting, and then this is a cut of the boosted sphere. So lambda is the boost parameter. It's like the hyperbolic cosine of the rapidity, something like that. So when lambda goes to 1, I am not boosting, so I get the spatial sphere. And when lambda goes to infinity, I'm boosting this sphere so much that it becomes null. Okay? But here, I'm interested in values of lambda close to 1, so that I can put them in this framework of infinitesimal deformations. Okay? So some trigonometry to compute the slope of this line shows that the equation for this boosted sphere, this gamma, has this form. So this form is not very interesting, except for the fact that if we now expand this in values of lambda near 1, so I'll write lambda as 1 plus delta lambda, then the curve changes by an amount which has a first order contribution in delta lambda, a second order contribution, and so on. And that's because here in the denominator, I have some rather complicated dependence on lambda. So there is a non-trivial relation between delta gamma, which is the Taylor expansion parameter that appears here, and delta lambda, which is the small boost parameter, okay? Okay, and now the key point is to say that because I'm thinking about the entanglement entropy of a Lorentz invariant state, the vacuum state, then the entanglement entropy should be the same if I look at the spatial sphere or a boosted sphere, okay? In other words, S of gamma plus delta lambda has to be equal to S of gamma if this delta lambda is a boost, okay? And so that will imply that there are relations between these different kernels that appear here. And basically, out of those relations will come the irreversibility proof. Okay? So that's basically the strategy. Now, at first order, in the boost, so where it says delta lambda, delta gamma, I'll plug in this expansion. So at first order, it turns out that the integral is trivial because it's an integral of some angle that gives zero. Okay? But at second order, we get something non-trivial. For example, if you plug this linear delta lambda term here, it will give a second order contribution. Okay? And if you plug this delta lambda square term here, it will also give a second order contribution. So a combination of those two second order contributions implies the following formula is here, implies that this angular integral of the second order kernel should be related to this angular integral of the first order kernel. So that gives that equality. And there are also similar equalities for higher order kernels that will not play a role in the talk. Okay. Now, as I said, in fact, this S1 is a constant, so this just, so the integral of S1 is basically what we call the standard derivative, right? So this has a d minus 3 s prime of r, but then the first term here is not exactly the second derivative of the entropy, which would be this double angular integral of the second derivative kernel, because it has this angular dependence in there. Okay? So what we'll do is, taking this equality, we'll add and subtract the second derivative. So from here to here, you just go by adding and subtracting this term. Okay? And now we want to see what's the sign of the left-hand side. So we need to understand the properties of the right-hand side, okay? So notice that this is a cosine, so 1 minus a cosine is always positive. And moreover, here on the right-hand side, when the two points are not coincident, then strong subadditivity implies that the second functional derivative of the entanglement entropy is negative. So the right-hand side is negative almost everywhere, except when the two points coincide. Because when the two points coincide, generically the entanglement entropy will be UV divergent, and then we cannot control the sign. Okay? And so to subtract those UV divergences, instead of thinking about the entanglement, the second derivative of the entanglement entropy, we want to think about the second derivative of the subtracting entropy. Remember, this is the delta S that I introduced before. It's the entropy for the QFT minus the entropy of the UV fixed point. Both have the same UV divergences, so those will cancel out, and then they will give something finite if I can use delta S here instead of S. Okay. Now, the problem is that, in general, delta S does not satisfy strong subadditivity, even if S does. Okay. But for the special case when, in the subtraction, I get the CFT vacuum here, the Markov property comes to our help, because this property implies precisely that the entanglement entropies for CFTs along the null deformations that I'm interested in, this boost, saturates the strong subadditive inequality. And that's a Markov property. Okay? So this was shown in this paper from 2017. And an infinitesimal version of this saturation, of course, implies that the second functional derivative of this term is zero. Okay? And since it's zero, I'm free to add it, and I'll know the sign of the second functional derivative of delta S, which will be the same as the sign of the second functional derivative of S. Okay? So this is a place where the Markov property comes in, because I want to control the infinity, so I want to write this for delta S, and then I use the Markov property to say that I know the sign in the right-hand side. Okay? So that's this last equation here. It's the same equation as before. Delta S is also Lorentz invariant, so you'll get this equality between the left-hand side and the right-hand side. And finally, as I said before, now I know the sign of delta S12. It's negative. This is positive. There are no UV divergences, so this integral is negative definite. Okay? And this gives the desired inequality that the left-hand side is less or equal than the right-hand side. And that's the alternative proof I was saying in the beginning. So it shows very clearly that the ingredients that go into there are first thinking about the constraints from Lorentz invariant, but then by doing an infinitesimal boost, okay? Then using strong subadditivity, okay? And finally using this Markov property to cancel the UV divergences. So those are the three steps in the proof. Now, it's a bit strange that delta S appears here, because delta S is not a quantum information measure, but it turns out we can rewrite this inequality in terms of the relative entropy, okay? So remember, this is the definition of the relative entropy between two density matrices, sigma and rho. Okay? And this relative entropy can be written as a difference between the modular Hamiltonian associated to sigma, so the log of sigma, and this delta S that appeared before, okay? Where I'm calling sigma to basically the vacuum density matrix of the UV fixed point, and rho to the vacuum density matrix of this QFT that undergoes a non-trivial RG flow. So I'm comparing these two density matrices using the relative entropy. Okay? So then the delta S that appears here is this delta S. And it turns out that the modular Hamiltonian does not contribute in the SSA because the Markov property can be shown to be equivalent that the modular Hamiltonian as an operator saturates this type of combination. So the modular Hamiltonian of x1 plus the modular Hamiltonian of x2 is equal to the modular Hamiltonian of the union and the modular Hamiltonian of the intersection. So because of that, I'm free to add the modular Hamiltonian here, and if the entropy satisfies the SSA, the relative entropy will be super additive. So the second derivative now will be positive. All the extra terms just give zero, okay? And so this inequality can also be written as an inequality for the relative entropy, okay? And I'm writing it this way here because in a few minutes we'll use a similar version to the one that appears here, okay? Now the two inequalities are equivalent, and in fact one can show that for QFT without defects, the entanglement entropy and the relative entropy have the same universal coefficient. Okay, so both inequalities are just zooming onto the same C central charge, F, or the A anomaly, and they will imply, both of them will imply their decrease. Okay. Okay, so this was a QFT story. Now in the second part, we'll move to adding defects. So let me give a short motivation for why we want to do that. So the situation we have in mind is a conformal field theory now in capital D space-time dimensions. And this conformal field theory has a planar defect that has little d space-time dimensions, okay? Now this situation is of interest in many different areas. For example, it first appeared many years ago in condensed matter physics via this famous Kondo model or impurities. It's, of course, very important in gauge theories where we want to understand the dynamics of different extended objects. In string theory with deep brains, generically we'd like to understand theories with boundaries and so on. So it's well motivated to understand what happens with QFT once we add these defects. Here I'll be just adding one defect that is shown here. Okay. And what we have in mind is that the theory in the bulk will always be conformal, but now there will be some non-trivial RG flow that will be localized here on the defect, for example, triggered because we are adding some relevant deformations on the defect. And so we assume that this flow starts from some UV conformal defect and then it ends on some different infrared conformal defect. While in the bulk, as I said, we always have the conformal symmetries, okay? And this picture is generally enough to include the cases with all codimensions, so our analysis will be valid for every capital D and small d. And moreover, it includes what we discussed in part one as a particular case, which is the situation where capital D is equal to small d, because then there are no codimensions, and then we just get a standard QFT with its RG flow that starts from some UV fixed point and ends in a different IR fixed point. Okay. Okay, and now, as before, we'll look at the entanglement entropy for a sphere centered on the defect. And the first idea one has is to try to prove that there are irreversibility theorems now for the new universal terms that appear in this entanglement entropy that are associated to the presence of the defect. And it turns out that in general, this doesn't work. And intuitively, it doesn't work because the defect contributes energy. So this equality we found, we discussed before, that the universal terms in the entanglement entropy and the relative entropy are the same here fails, okay? Because there is a difference now between the universal terms of the entanglement entropy and the relative entropy because this effect is now contributing to the modular Hamiltonian, okay? So we'll, in what follows, we'll focus on the relative entropy, okay? And again, there is some technical detail that I won't get into, which is that this relative entropy needs to be computed on a particular Cauchy surface for the sphere, which is the Cauchy surface that approaches the past null limit or the future null limit, okay? But modulo that statement, basically it's not hard to understand the behavior that this relative entropy has. In the UV, it goes to zero because we are comparing two states that are the same because all these relevant interactions vanish in the UV, so the state sigma and the state rho are just the same. In the middle, there is some non-perturbative behavior as a function of r that is hard to compute. And finally, when r goes to infinity, the sigma state doesn't flow, but the rho state flows to an infrared fixed point, which is in general different from the UV fixed point. So the relative entropy turns out to have an expansion, which is very similar to the expansion in entanglement entropy, but in general with different coefficients, okay? So there's an area term and so on, and then there are here the universal terms. And delta means differences. So delta mu is the difference between mu of the IR theory and mu of the UV theory, and the same for these guys. And there are primes to say that these terms are in general different from the universal terms in the entanglement entropy. Okay, good. And so now we'll do the same thing as we did before. So basically, we'll consider infinitesimal deformations of this sphere. Okay, we can just repeat the same calculation as before, but now for the relative entropy. And because the relative entropy is Lorentz invariant, there should be connections between the first order kernel, second order kernel, and so on. Okay, and I use a very similar notation. I call S1 to the first functional derivative of the relative entropy, S12 is the second functional derivative, etc. And from their integrals, we can compute the ordinary derivative with respect to the radius and so on. Okay, and similar steps to what I showed before give that there is a relation between, the explicit relation between the first order kernel and the second order kernel is the one shown here, okay? So it's very similar to the equation before, except for the fact that now, you know, the first order kernel is no longer a constant because the defect has broken some of the rotational symmetries, okay? So now I can no longer do this integral explicitly, which before is what gave this factor of d minus 3. So now I can, this integral is there, okay? And the x parallel means that this is the unit, this unit angle evaluated in the direction of the boost. So I'm boosting a sphere, I can only boost in the direction of the defect because the other symmetries are broken, and I get this equality, okay? And finally, we need to massage this equality a little bit to get what we want, so we'll add and subtract the combinations of first derivative and second derivatives, and you get to something like this. Here, the only non-trivial thing that happened is that I combined this single integral with this double integral by using the delta function here. But then it's just a rewriting by adding and subtracting the same terms, okay? Now, again, we want to understand the sign of the left-hand side, so we need to look at the sign of the right-hand side. It turns out that when the two points are different, then this delta function doesn't contribute, and so by strong superadditivity of the relative entropy, the right-hand side is positive. Okay, so we only have to worry about what happens at coincidence points. Okay, now, if the two points coincide but we are on the defect, okay, then basically this delta function kills itself with this factor because on the defect this will give a zero. Okay. And so we only have to worry about what happens with the coincident points when we are away from the defect. And that's where the QNEC comes in, because the QNEC on the Lyacon is precisely the statement that for a CFT, this second combination of these kernels has a sign that we can prove it to be true. Okay. And in our situation, we can use the QNEC, which is valid for CFTs, because as I said, we only have to apply it in the bulk, and if we in the bulk, we always get the conformal symmetries, okay? So these remaining points that where we didn't know what was happening, now they are bounded by the quantum neurology condition, and therefore, in all the ranges of this double integral that we have to do, the right-hand side is positive, okay? So this is the extra ingredient that didn't appear before. We have to use the QNEC to constrain this, okay? And given that, we can prove this general formula that was the main result I wanted to arrive to, okay? Now, an important property of this formula, so it's the same I showed before when there were no defects, and that's because this formula is independent of D, the dimension of the bulk CFT, okay? So essentially what this is doing, it's extending all known irreversibility theorems in QFT without defects to the case when there is a defect of dimension little d. And it's not hard to check by plugging this type of formula in there that, good, thanks, that you can prove that, for example, in two space-time dimensions, this C function decreases on the defect. In three space-time dimensions, F decreases. And in four space-time dimensions, A decreases. Okay. And again, these universal terms are now the ones in the relative entropy and not the ones in the entanglement entropy. And as I said, beyond four dimensions, we are not powerful enough to reach to the universal terms. Okay, so let me conclude. So here, to summarize, we have a table of the status of all irreversibility theorems. In the left-hand side, you have the defect dimension, and in the right-hand side, you have the bulk dimension. For example, this entry here would be defect of dimension 2, bulk of dimension 2. That's the standard C theorem. This is the standard F theorem, this is the standard A theorem, and now all these theorems have been extended to all these extra rows here, which means that they are theorems proved on defects that live inside some CFT of arbitrary dimension, okay? In particular, some of the theorems were known before. The ones that were not known before are the ones here shaded in blue that can be also proved with this formula. Okay? So I'll stop there. Of course, it would be great if we can extend some of these ideas beyond four dimensions, so there is something going on that could be interesting, but we have no clue so far. Okay, thank you very much.
Any questions?
Hi.
Hi, Mark. So thanks for listening for the second time to the talk.
it was a different talk, but anyway.
Yeah.
For the higher dimensional case, either just for the bulk or for a defect, I mean, is there, if I just ask, like,
in the bulk, I can go to any dimension here because the bulk is always conformal. So the only thing that stops me is the dimension of the defect.
Okay.
So that's why this stops at d equals 4. Beyond d equals 4, I don't know what happens.
Right. Okay. So in either case,
yeah.
I mean, is there some inequality that you could just write down that would imply, or some space of inequalities you could write down that
yeah.
would imply the
result? Those inequalities are known.
Check
yeah.
whether which ones
yeah.
are true.
Yeah, it's very hard to check. But essentially, you know, the hope that we have is that there are, you know, there are in fact similar relations to the ones I wrote, like this one. So there are similar relations between higher order kernels also
right.
that can be derived from Lorentz invariant. But it's very hard to relate them to the inequalities we need because they include complicated angular factors there. And so if nobody tells me what's the sign of, say, the fourth derivative, then I don't know. It becomes really a computational problem that is hard to do. But we are exploring that now. I mean, but I don't have anything
so
useful to say.
It might be that there's some inequality.
It
like
could be that SSA plus these relations is enough to go beyond four dimensions, but it's not. That's not clear yet.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks.
Oh, coming. No.
Hi, thanks.
Thanks.
Yeah, just a kind of basic question. You said the universal term in the relative entropy is the same, those coefficients are the same as in the entanglement entropy, or?
Only for QFTs without defects. For QFTs with defects, the defect is contributing a universal term that comes from the modular Hamiltonian, and then they are different.
Oh, and okay, do you have to use the relative entropy in that?
Yeah,
case?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's one reason, but the main reason to use the relative entropy is that I need the QNEC once there is a defect, and the QNEC uses the relative entropy. Or if you want, you can rewrite the QNEC in terms of the entanglement entropy, but then it has this integral of the null energy on the left-hand side. So if you combine the second derivative of the entanglement entropy plus this, with this bound of the integral of the null energy, it becomes a convexity statement for the relative entropy, which is this one here, basically. This is written in the LIGO.
Okay.
So this statement is true for the relative entropy, but it's not true for the entanglement entropy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I need to use the relative entropy.
Okay, but then the basic question, is there a reason, is it easy to see that those universal terms are the same in the absence of defects, or how do you?
Yeah, the reason is that basically the expectation value of the modular Hamiltonian is zero.
Oh.
So if you want, I mean, the free energy on the sphere has the same universal term as the entanglement entropy because there is no energy there.
Okay.
But the defect brings its own energy.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
I mean, if there are no more questions, then we can thank Gonzalo again.
Okay, thanks.